behind the bar if some of you ladies who are standing want to sit there. Once all the lawyers got up, we have plenty of seats. It's regular time, but I mean, we extended. Okay, we will hear from Mr. Barnes. Representing the state of Mississippi, I suppose.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The Constitution does not protect or provide a woman the right to have an unsafe abortion. The Constitution provides only the right to have an abortion performed by qualified medical personnel under circumstances which ensure the maximum safety for the mother. Laws which have a rational basis and which do not impose an undue burden are constitutional.
And which do not pose undue burden. So that's what you really need to. It seems to me you've got a steep hill to climb when you say the only abortion clinic in a state is closed. No abortion provider is available. May be more than an undue burden. It seems like that's a. So why don't you focus on that? The district court did not address rationality, and why don't you just focus on whether it's an undue burden?
Yes, Your Honor. The courts that have considered this issue have focused on the geographical availability of the abortion procedure, not the artificial barrier of a state line. There's nothing inherently burdensome about crossing a state line. In Abbott, the court looked at the geographical availability of care and the incidental burden involved in the additional travel time, distance, or expense. In Casey, the court looked at not only the...
Given that point, how do you get around Gaines?
Well, Gaines is an old... 1938, equal protection, Plessy v. Ferguson, separate but equal case. And in that case, Missouri conferred a benefit on white citizens.
I know the fact. How do you get around the holding of that case?
The fact that, Your Honor, that case has not been cited in the abortion context or in this substantive due process context.
What difference does that make? I mean, it stands for a real principle. Seems to me, and that is that the state of Mississippi cannot shift its obligation to provide constitutional rights to its citizens to another state.
Your Honor,
we're talking about the Mississippi state law here.
Your Honor, Mississippi is not attempting to pass its obligation onto other states.
I know, but the effect of it is.
Well, Your Honor, I think the one way that the Gaines case is distinguishable is that it was the conferring a benefit on citizens that, and the fact that the state did not provide equal facilities for African Americans was the key to that case. This case before you, is not an equal.
It said that a state cannot force its constitutional obligations on another state. I mean, the 14th Amendment. Obligations under the 14th Amendment cannot be shifted away from a state and imposed on another state. I mean, you are the one that owes that obligation to your citizens, is the principle that the gangs stand for, which sounds pretty correct to me.
Well, Your Honor, Gaines is 76 years old and has never been cited in the abortion context. And, Your Honor, you would think that if that was
the Constitution is pretty old too.
Yes, sir, it is.
The Amendment is pretty old.
It is, but we would have expected to see Gaines cited, it certainly at least even earlier in this case, since this issue has been in the case from the beginning, never been cited by the plaintiffs in any of their briefs. It didn't show up until their 28J response to our 28J letter concerning Abbott.
Now, but it's before us now, is it not?
Your Honor?
It's before us now.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It is. But again, here...
Probably so, I mean. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor.
But for you to say you'd expect, wouldn't, if your distinguishing of Gaines applied, wouldn't you expect that in the Casey case, the Supreme Court would have said, well, parental notification might be constitutional because you could go to a neighboring state that doesn't require it? That analysis has never come into play that I've seen.
It is true, Your Honor, the Supreme Court has not directly addressed this issue in any case which I'm familiar with.
Have you? I don't. It's not in the briefs. Have you since the briefs found a case that does factor in the law and circumstances of neighboring states to assess whether there's an undue burden? Because in your brief, it's just pages 47, 48. You cite the 11th Circuit decision, but that's a minimum context case, correct?
I am not. I'm aware.
You see the slipperiness, and you're constrained by Abbott. So are we. So you're obviously that's a rule that has intervened. But the logic of the rule you're suggesting to us would mean that the 14th Amendment right varies depending on the circumstances in neighboring states. And behind Gaines, the concern is that diminishes Alabama and Louisiana's ability to choose. You see my point?
I do, Your Honor. But the opposite is true also, in that going that direction would create a difference in the police power between a state like Texas, which is a large state with many abortion providers, and a state like Mississippi, which is small and only has one, or states which might only have a limited number of providers. We think that each state has the same police power to protect its citizens, the same right to protect its citizens and to require high standards. And Texas should not be permitted to provide greater protection to women seeking abortions than Mississippi. And again, moving away from Gaines, it was an equal protection case. Equal protection, the essence of equal protection is in-state discrimination based on irrational or discriminatory classifications. So that case does not speak directly to the due process issue before this court.
You're saying, can I quickly summarize? You tell me if I'm wrong. You're saying the district court committed legal error because the undue burden test requires a balancing of effect with rationality. That's one argument. Now, they point to footnote 3 to suggest the district court might have done that. But separately, they point to Casey and Abbott saying, really, it's always been two separate inquiries. Then you say, well, regardless, there's a factual clear error because the mileage principle set up in Abbott exists here. Is that the sort of orbit of your arguments, legal and factual?
To some extent, yes, Your Honor. The district court in the preliminary injunction does not include any analysis beyond about the medical benefits that might be provided. It includes a couple of conclusory statements. You've got the statement in footnote 3.
We decided in Abbott that you're right there. This is rational. This, according to our court, maternal health is being protected by this regulation. That's your proposition. Aren't you saying that? The Abbott decision decided the rationality problem.
It did, but the district court, we believe that whether you call it express balancing when you're in conducting the undue burden analysis or whether it's a consideration or weighing of the interest, we think that the state's interest, the medical benefits provided by the law, do play a role and should inform the court's ultimate decision as to whether or not the law imposes an undue burden. Here, the district court reached a conclusion early on in this case, almost immediately in the very first injunction in 2012. The court said closing the only clinic in the state without any further other considerations in and of itself is an undue burden. We think that is an error because if that was the case, any law which might have the impact of closing the only abortion clinic in a state would be per se unconstitutional.
They aren't arguing that, and that doesn't seem to be a necessary corollary. One answer to that is this is as applied. We haven't yet seen that they aren't paying taxes or they're being unsanitary. So the facts don't present that to us. The second argument would be this: the district court's made findings that this is an impossibility, that they can't comply.
We disagree that it is an impossibility, Your Honor. We agree that only if the circumstances remain unchanged that it is unlikely that the clinic would remain open.
It's why did you only argue that on the reply instead of with your in your initial brief?
Before you answer, Judge Garza, let me just make it clear that we're not going to hold you to the time. This case is a little different from some of the others. And so we're going to let you make your argument, whatever it is, so give you time to do that. So go ahead, Judge Clark.
Yeah. Why didn't you bring this up with your primary brief instead of in a reply?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Exactly which point?
We're talking about the what are we talking about?
No, you're right. In the reply, if I could, the reply brief is where you said market forces might resolve this. In other words, you began to back off the district court's finding that of unavailability. In the principal brief, you don't attack that as clear error, but in the reply brief, you do.
Because the situation has changed during the course of briefing. As the district court noted, the situation is fluid.
Yeah, but our court in Abbott did not allow consideration of anything outside the record after the ruling on review. What's the situation's changed?
Five of the hospitals that denied the applications for privileges administratively have been sold. They're owned by another company. They're under new management. So if I...
That's not even in your reply.
No, Your Honor, it is not. But I think it is in response to the question of why we do not think this would necessarily close the clinic. I think it is relevant.
My point, I just remembered, is this: that you make for the first time in your reply brief that there's at least one doctor with privileges, and therefore the clinic does not shut down because at least there's one doctor with privileges. But that argument wasn't made in your primary brief. I just wondered why.
Your Honor, that is included in the facts section of our primary brief. If we did not address specifically argue it, I think perhaps we thought it went without saying, but it is in the facts section that Dr. Rowe is the local physician who has privileges.
Well, now, secondly, one of the rationales here is that the that abortion providers are now brought into the scope of ambulatory surgery facilities. Okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is an ambulatory surgical facility, and why, according to Mississippi, is abortion providing facility come within that category?
Well, under Mississippi law, an abortion clinic can be either a level one facility and perform abortions up to 16 weeks, which is this clinic is a class one facility, or they can be level two. Level two facilities are only required to, or can only perform abortions through the first trimester. Level one abortion facilities are required to comply with not only the minimum standards for abortion facilities, but also the minimum standards for ambulatory surgical facilities.
And again, tell me what an ambulatory surgical facility is.
An ambulatory surgical facility is defined in the statute, and I can't quote it to you, but it's a facility, a freestanding clinic where outpatient surgical procedures are performed on a regular basis. Many procedures that traditionally would have been performed in a hospital are now performed at like surgical centers.
Like what? What are we talking about?
Colonoscopies, pain management procedures.
So colonoscopies, what else?
Certain types of eye surgeries, cataract surgeries, Your Honor. I can't give you an exhaustive list off the top of my head.
When you come back up, maybe there's a statute that defines what ambulatory surgical facilities are. You'd give it to us, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
Continue with the rest of your...
Is there an anti-discrimination law equivalent to the one that was cited by our court in Abbott?
You're talking about the Texas state law.
The Texas state law that says that hospitals can't decredential or revoke or refuse to give.
There is not an equivalent state law in Mississippi. However, hospitals' decisions as to giving privileges is not unfettered under Mississippi law. hospitals are required to comply with the minimum standards for hospitals, which sets forth certain criteria. The hospitals have to include well-defined written criteria in their bylaws and to consider
applications. Could they refuse to credential someone because it's adverse to the reputation of the hospital?
Your Honor, I am... I don't know of any specific provision that permits that. I'm also not taking the position that the hospitals do not have the authority. I'm simply not aware of a provision that addresses it one way or the other.
Privileges are totally the authority of the of really not the hospital, but the doctors within the hospital that either peer review their credentials, as I understand it.
Your Honor, and
now,
yes,
that Mississippi may be different, but that's generally speaking.
No, Your Honor, that's correct. And the minimum standards for hospitals place that obligation on the medical staff of the hospitals and provide that the hospitals should provide recommendations.
And I'm assuming that Mississippi, there's a difference between the medical staff. They're not employees of the hospital. They're independent contractors that come in.
That is true, Your Honor. While there might be some doctors who are employees of the hospital, traditionally the medical staff are doctors that have
radiology, pathology, and that type of
OBGYN, yes, Your Honor, et cetera. And that's particularly relevant here because that's where the staff to provide specific specialty services such as OBGYN, those doctors come from the medical staff. If all doctors, you know, first of all, you know, it's important that Mississippi does require this of other doctors performing outpatient procedures and has required it for over 10 years. And if all doctors were treated the same as these doctors wish to be, that is, that they fly in, perform procedures, and fly out with no further responsibility for managing complications, there would be no medical specialty coverage. And as Dr. Thorpe and Dr. Anderson noted in their declarations, or Dr. Thorpe specifically, over 78% of the hospitals in the country have a shortage of specialty coverage. The admitting privileges law does speak to that issue. It helps Mississippi improve a system where to ensure that there is adequate specialty coverage, and it also improves a system which Dr. Anderson noted is inadequate and accepts inadequate communication as the norm.
But part of the problem with assessing 1390 under the continuity of care logic is that 1390 is you're marrying with an argument that says they should go 3 hours to Alabama or Louisiana, which necessarily will mean there will be discontinuity. So it is a little bit ironic to be saying the critical argument for 1390 is immediate continuity of care, but then the legal basis says they can go to Alabama and Louisiana.
Well, Your Honor, I think the question really becomes, is Abbott correct that the first half of the analysis is rational basis scrutiny? Because if it is, it's any rational basis, not the best rational basis or the best argument or that the legislature has made the best decision. And so...
Right. Okay.
And so I am not saying that the legislative decision is necessarily a perfect solution or the best solution, but it is a solution permitted under rational basis scrutiny.
In regards to rational basis, and the only place really that I see it, there was some mention in Casey, but in Gonzalez it says, where it has a rational basis to act and it does not impose an undue burden. And that's the only language that I see. I don't see any other explanation for whether there's a tension between that or it's a flow that one informs the other or vice versa. That's the only thing we really got to go on as far as the Supreme Court is concerned.
Your Honor, I agree that neither Casey nor Gonzalez provided a great deal of explanation or assistance in understanding the principles. However, I would suggest that the Supreme Court justices are not inclined to throw out loaded terms of art like rational basis unless they mean it.
Why do you say, the fact of that it says rational basis and undue burden, and you've got to prove both of them, and so if it's an undue burden, you can lay aside a rational basis analysis.
Your Honor, I don't think that a court can properly determine whether a burden is undue or whether a law unduly interferes with a woman's right to choose unless you consider the state's interest. There is an implied, whether it's expressed or implied, so whether it's implicit or explicit, courts considering abortion rights going back to Roe have noted that you have to balance, there has to be some balancing in consideration of the interest. If the district court had applied rational basis analysis here, determined, looked at the basis of this law, determined consistent with Abbott that it had a rational basis, that would then give it a very strong presumption of constitutionality.
Why, in the back and forth in the district court here, why isn't his footnote 3 remark even giving an enhanced value? It's a necessary interest. Why isn't that consideration?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor, could you repeat the question?
The district court, I thought it was in footnote 3, said even if there's a necessary interest, I still find.
Right. But nowhere would you find the district court, the analysis or the findings or the consideration. I mean, the district
court. Were the two experts that defended the maternal health aspect the same two that testified in Texas?
They were two of the experts. You had Dr. Thorpe and Anderson.
Does the Mississippi legislative history behind 1390 include similar doctor professional testimony? Do you know?
It does not. Your Honor, as I'm in Mississippi, we basically do not have official legislative history. I'm not aware of official history where testimony was introduced. There may have been hearings, Your Honor, but I'm not aware that any records are kept.
The reason I ask that, of course, you've read the amicus briefs, and then the district court sort of alluded to the public statements that he said might also constitute constitutional infirmity because of purpose, unconstitutional purpose. Do you have a thought about that, or is your answer it wasn't decided on that basis?
Well, the first part of my answer is it wasn't decided on that basis, Your Honor. But also, I would expand on that and say that the press releases and public statements, political statements made by certain individual officials do not speak to the intent, the overall intent of the legislature, the over 170 Mississippi legislators who voted for this law. They have very limited evidentiary value and are probative only of the personal beliefs of those individuals. I think Governor Bryant covered this well in his amicus brief, where he pointed out that his statement was really taken out of context a little bit, in that he made no bones about the fact that his personal belief is that Roe is wrong and should be overturned, and it was his personal hope that one day abortions would not be performed in Mississippi. However, he did then stress that this law does protect maternal health. And in sum, you know, the judge, Governor Bryant was saying, I would rather abortions not be performed in Mississippi, but so long as they are, I want to make sure that they're performed under conditions which protect the health of the women. And so I don't think those statements are probative. The district judge did not make any finding. You know, he just referred to it as a thorny question and didn't go any further.
Do you have anything else you would like to say? Any other points you'd like to make?
Your Honor, I would just like to say that Mississippi is somewhat unique in that it is surrounded by neighboring metropolitan areas where abortion clinics and abortion facilities are available. The 170-mile figure, or three-hour figure, it's treated as if, or argued as if, that it applies to every woman in the state of Mississippi, and that is simply not true. The majority of women in Mississippi who choose to have abortions already go out of state. There are a little over 5,000 abortions where either performed in Mississippi or Mississippi women obtain them. Over 3,000 in 2011 and in 2012 chose to go out of state. Only a little over 2,000 had their abortions done at this clinic.
How do we know that?
That's in the statistics from the Mississippi State Department of Health. They're cited.
How we know that?
It's there in the record.
It is in the record, Your Honor, but it's based on the statistics, official statistics from the health department. And so limiting the inquiry only to consideration of in-state availability of care is inconsistent with the way that Mississippi women are actually exercising their constitutional right at this time. There is no woman in the state of Mississippi who is more than a three-hour, 170-mile drive from one of these other facilities. Most Mississippi women are much closer to those facilities. And such as the Memphis metropolitan area is a good example.
But that backs you up into the Missouri versus Canada problem. And, I mean, Jackson to New Orleans is about 3 hours. And if I'm not mistaken, Louisiana is considering similar legislation. Alabama's either got it and it's going to trial in May. So your rule, if it, what would we face that, would the case that Mississippi's proposing be different if both of those states chose the same choice that Mississippi chose?
We think this case turns on the authority of the state to regulate the health and safety of women. And where there is geographical availability of care, we think that the practical effect is where this court should concentrate. That is, what incidental burden or increased burden might there be? The plaintiffs noted.
Do you acknowledge then that if Alabama and Louisiana pass statutes similar to that of Mississippi?
I am aware of Alabama, and I know that Louisiana was considering it.
Does that undermine your argument?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I don't think it does, because I think you have to look at each state's actions as far as, did the state have a rational basis? Is the purpose of the law maternal health? If the purpose of the law is maternal health, and if the state is properly exercising its police power, then we think that it doesn't matter if another state might conceivably in the future take action, whether or not some clinics might close in other states. The situation now is there is geographical availability of care.
Okay, any further questions from you, Judge Clark? Thank you very much, Mr. Barnes. We will now hear from Mr. Reichel. Ms. Reichel, excuse me.
May it please the court, my name is Julie Rickelman, and I represent the plaintiffs in this case. On April 18th of last year, the Mississippi Department of Health stood poised to revoke the license of the last abortion clinic in the state of Mississippi because the clinic's physicians had not been able to secure admitting privileges at any local Jackson area hospital as the act required. 3 days earlier, on April 15th, the district court entered the preliminary injunction that is on appeal here. The court entered the injunction so that the clinic's license would not be revoked and so that Mississippi would not become the first state in the country to effectively eliminate access to legal abortion. The preliminary injunction, which the district court specifically said was based on this law as applied to this clinic based on this record, was not an abuse of discretion. In deciding to enter preliminary injunctive relief, the court made a series of factual findings. It found that the plaintiff had exhausted all avenues to comply with the admitting privileges requirement. That nevertheless, yes, Your Honor.
Did the district court consider the fact that there was one doctor that did have privileges?
Yes, Your Honor, it did. In fact, the state made the argument to the district court that Dr. Rowe had privileges, but the district court rejected the state's argument as a factual matter because the record was clear that that doctor can only provide extremely limited care, and therefore it would not be a substitute to have him be the only provider.
What did the state argue as far as that is concerned? That's, to me, this is kind of an unusual deal. This is, if one person complies with the statute, maybe the other two doctors can't provide abortion services, but this doctor can. And does that, I don't know what the rationale is, if you would explain.
Sure, Your Honor. The district court found that this doctor can't provide the services because he has his own practice and he provides only extremely limited abortion care at the clinic. And the state had absolutely no contrary evidence. Its suggestion that Dr. Rowe could step in was based purely on speculation. That's exactly what the district court said. And for that reason, the district court's factual finding on this issue is not clearly erroneous. The court also found that the state would close the clinic without preliminary relief, that once the clinic, because the clinic was the only known abortion provider in the state, once the clinic was closed, Mississippi women would have to leave the state to access legal abortion services. The district court also found that the physicians had tried to secure privileges at every local Jackson area hospital, that two of the hospitals had refused even to allow them to apply, and the other five had denied their applications for administrative reasons without considering their qualifications because they were abortion providers. None of these facts were contested by contrary evidence from defendants. Indeed, the defendants conceded a number of the key issues before the court. Defendants conceded that as soon as the Mississippi Department of Health issued its notice of its intent to revoke the clinic's license, any harm to the clinic and its patients would no longer be speculative. And that notice was issued in January, 3 months before the district court's preliminary injunction order. The state also conceded that if, in fact, the physicians were not able to obtain privileges at any local area hospital, it would, frankly, cut against the state under the undue burden analysis.
If none of the doctors, is that what you said?
If the physicians who were applying for privileges were unable to secure them, Your Honor, that it would frankly cut against the state in terms of the undue burden analysis, and that is what happened here.
The two.
Correct, Your Honor, yes.
Intervening, we have decisional law, Abbott.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if the Abbott rule controls us here, my concerns about the rule are that the same rule that we upheld as constitutional in Texas, we're now saying because of different circumstances here would be unconstitutional. So it's odd to have a 14th Amendment constitutionality determination be constitutional in one state, unconstitutional in another.
Yes, Your Honor. This preliminary injunction, however, is entirely consistent with the Abbott panel opinion because Abbott said very clearly that a law that restricts abortion is unconstitutional either if it is irrational or if it imposes an undue burden. And in fact, the court wrote in Abbott that even though the state of Texas had articulated rational bases for the Texas admitting privileges law, Planned Parenthood could have succeeded in that case if it had shown that the effect of the law substantially burdened women's access to abortion in Texas. And that's exactly what the plaintiffs showed here and exactly what the district court found below.
Right, but then, so what's your position if somewhere else in Mississippi there were one other clinic under the Abbott rule, would this be a different constitutional analysis? If there were one open one somewhere else in Mississippi?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think you need to reach that question here because the preliminary injunction that's on appeal here was an as-applied injunction. The district court was very clear that he was entering this relief based on this law and as applied to this clinic based on these facts.
Okay. But, go ahead.
But he didn't cite any authority for that. I mean, we proposed this Missouri versus Canada. Is that what you're going on? Or what's your authority that there has to be at least one abortion facility in Mississippi?
Yes, Your Honor. We cited the Gaines case in our 28J response to respond to the state's argument about.
And I think at a certain level you're absolutely correct, except for this. You're talking about in Gaines a law school that was created, funded, sponsored, whatever you want to call it, by the state of Missouri. Here we do not have a abortion facility sponsored or by the Mississippi state. There's in that case also there was equal protection. This is a due process claim. It seems to me that there's some rationality. If you create a law school, then you have to deal with people in their admissions constitutionally. Here, the state of Mississippi did not create this abortion facility, and it seems to me a distance between this facts and the Missouri case.
Your Honor, I believe that the Gaines case squarely supports our arguments here. You are correct that it was a case that dealt with the Equal Protection Clause, and the court in that case found that the state of Missouri had violated the Equal Protection Clause when it denied admission to the plaintiff to its law school because he was black. Even though in that case—
The state did.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. And in fact, the state in that case had offered to pay for the plaintiff to attend law school in a nearby state, and the Supreme Court said that was not enough. And it said so based on a principle that applies equally here. The court said that the ability of the plaintiff to go to law school in another state may mitigate the discrimination that the plaintiff had suffered, but it could not serve to validate it. And the same exact principle applies here, Your Honor. The fact that women can leave the state of Mississippi to obtain abortion in a nearby state may mitigate the impact of the constitutional due process violation,
but it doesn't validate it. The assumption of this case seems to be that Missouri established some entity, this school, this university, and must treat its students under the equal protection. If Missouri had not had a university or a school of law, that rule would not apply, it seems to me.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree with that reading of the case. What the Supreme Court said, and if I may quote from the decision.
And what page are you?
I am on page 351, Your Honor.
Just a minute. What head note?
789.
Yeah, okay, you have it.
What the Supreme Court said there was that manifestly the obligation of the state to give the equal protection of the laws can be performed only where its laws operate, that is, within its own jurisdiction. And I would say that the same exact principle applies here, Your Honor. The Due Process Clause, which follows immediately after the, or immediately before the Equal Protection Clause, excuse me, in the 14th Amendment, the state's obligation to provide due process of law can only be performed where its laws operate, and that is within the state's own jurisdiction.
Did the Supreme Court in Casey, which is this context, consider the neighboring states and whether or not they had parental notification requirements?
They did not, Your Honor, and that's the other reason why the state borders argument made by defendants was correctly rejected by the district court as a matter of law. In fact, no court has ever made that argument because it is inconsistent with Casey. In Casey, the Supreme Court found that the spousal notification requirement was an undue burden, and it did so without considering whether Pennsylvania women could leave the state and go to New York, New Jersey, or Delaware to avoid a similar restriction.
One question that I've got about this rule is it would seem like you'd have to have a codicil. In other words, your rule would be no state can enact a regulation that will close all clinics. But there has to be an unless, because as they argue forcefully in their brief, if the violation is a critical one or non-payment of taxes, the Mississippi could then have a reality where there would be no operating clinic because the clinic has violated a valid regulation. So how do you write the rule that encompasses their concern to defend crucial regulations?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the rule is the undue burden test. And for a law that was a property tax law, for instance, which was the example provided, I don't believe that law would be subject to the undue burden test. But when the state imposes an abortion restriction, like it did here with 1390,
But it isn't just an abortion restriction. What Mississippi is saying is this is leveling up. I mean, their argument is that this is the same regulation applied to all similarly situated facilities.
That's not correct, Your Honor. 1390 selects abortion clinics for uniquely burdensome regulations.
Now this gets back, I believe, to Judge Garza's questions about what is an ambulatory, what's it called?
Ambulatory surgical facility.
So it isn't, you would say this is not a rule that all other ambulatory surgical facilities?
No, Your Honor. The clinic is not an ambulatory surgical facility, and it's never been licensed as one. The state of Mississippi has required it to comply with many of those requirements because, again, the clinic's been targeted for unique regulation for some time, and the clinic, because it wants to comply with state law, has done everything possible to comply with every regulation imposed on it. And in fact, the Department of Health had inspected the clinic several times in the months right before the act was set to take effect, and each time found that the clinic was in compliance with all applicable state laws and regulations that were in effect at that time, but it cannot comply with this requirement. And this requirement must be subject to the undue burden standard. And here, the district court was absolutely correct that by effectively eliminating access to all abortion in the state of Mississippi, this law likely would pose an undue burden. And he didn't abuse his discretion by entering a preliminary injunction in that circumstance.
Mr. Goldman, one of the things, he'd never talked about the rational basis here, and this is, and it really dovetails with undue burden, and that is this. When an abortion goes south, when there is a cut in the uterus and a woman starts bleeding and the doctor says, whoa, just go over to the emergency room, I don't know of any specialty, especially these doctors are board certified, that drops a patient and says, go to the emergency room. Most board certified people take you from preliminary to surgical, and then they take care of you if something goes wrong. Now, I agree with you. It's sort of like colonoscopies. Really adverse effects, generally speaking. But even in a colonoscopy, if that goes south, you're talking about a life and death situation. Doesn't that make the statute rational? Now, it may be undue, but at the very least, it makes it rational.
I would answer two things to that, Your Honor. First of all, the clinic and its physicians care very much about the safety of their patients. They would never drop a patient. If a patient experiences a complication, the physician would first attempt to address the complication in the clinic, and the vast majority of complications, as you noted yourself, are addressed in that way. If it's a complication that physician can't address because some complications are better addressed by other types of physicians, not an OB-GYN, then the physician would transfer the patient to the hospital under the clinic's standing transfer arrangement and would stay in contact with the doctor treating the patient. But this law, Your Honor, as applied to these facts, is not rational because the effect of this law will be to force women to leave the state of Mississippi so that Mississippi will no longer have any authority or any power to discipline or deal with the medical practices or the physicians that treat their patients. And it also won't further the state's interest in credentialing. That was the other interest the state asserted, because as the record here shows, the hospitals in the local Jackson area would not even consider the qualifications of the doctors.
Is the essence of your argument that it crosses state borders, or are you arguing that the distance is the undue burden?
Your Honor, our position is that the district court here did not abuse his discretion in finding that this law, if allowed to take effect and to close down the clinic several days later, would have imposed an undue burden by effectively eliminating all access to abortion in the state, and that decision is squarely in line with the Abbott panel opinion. And as I indicated, it's also in line with Casey, because if I may return to your earlier question, Judge Higginson, Casey looked at a number of abortion restrictions, not just spousal notification. All of those restrictions were subjected to the substantial obstacle test. If state borders were irrelevant to that test, it's inconceivable that the court would have spent so many pages detailing a lengthy analysis and not mention that this was a new part of the legal standard that it was articulating.
So the part of the difficulty acknowledged by the district judge is the substantial obstacle test did come with the same sentence that had an unnecessary regulation. So they're inferring from that word that there's some bleed over, flow, tension between the two. But I see that Abbott pretty much restricts us on the rationality aspect. But your point also is Abbott made it clear the two are utterly separate, and Casey doesn't seem to imply that they bleed over. Question for you. I know you'll know this off the top of your head. What's the circuit array right now on admitting privileges?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a case going to trial in the Seventh Circuit, the Wisconsin case, after it was remanded from the Seventh Circuit's decision in Van Hollen upholding the preliminary injunction against the Wisconsin case. There's also a case going to trial in Alabama. I believe one of your honors mentioned that later this month. That has not been up to the 11th Circuit yet. It's been at the trial court level the entire time.
And the stay in Abbott went up, and the court split 5-4.
The stay panel opinion, yes, Your Honor, that went up. That opinion by the Supreme Court there was a very narrow one. And in fact, Justice Scalia said that the question of whether or not the stay should have been issued was one on which reasonable minds could disagree, but he did not feel that the procedural requirements for overturning the Court of Appeals decision on a stay had been met in that case.
Did somebody say that there was four votes already ready to go on this, on that case?
Justice Breyer did say, Your Honor, that he believed that four justices of the court would be willing to take the Texas case one way or the other. And then, of course, the Abbott panel opinion is currently subject to a petition for rehearing en banc in this court.
You know, often in difficult cases, I've noticed, only having been on this court for a couple years, difficult issues are subordinated to footnotes. And the difficult ones for me here are footnotes 2, 3, and 5. And I asked your opposing counsel about them. Do you care to pick any of the three? The footnote 2, I think, is the non-delegation issue. Can a state avoid an undue burden by allowing a third party? Footnote 3 is whether or not this district judge assessed rationality and applied it. And footnote 5 is, you remind me what footnote 5 is. It's whether the governor's statement that he wants no abortions affects a purpose. You want to talk about any of the three?
Yes, I would be happy to talk about this. Starting with the last note, footnote 5. I don't believe the court needs to reach the thorny purpose questions. Okay. The district court was clear that the preliminary injunction he entered here was based on effect, not on purpose. With respect to footnote 3, Your Honor, as the district court said, the unnecessary word came in the Supreme Court's summary of the standard, and the district court said that it wasn't clear how that was supposed to be applied. What I would say, Your Honor, is that Casey, at pages 900 to 901 of the opinion, did evaluate one health regulation. The vast majority of the restrictions at issue in that case, Your Honor, had to do with the potential life interests, not with health, but there was one health restriction considered. It was about record keeping. And what the Supreme Court did in that case was consistent with how it had treated health restrictions in the past. It looked to see if the health restriction was furthering an important state interest and if there was some fit between what the state's purported goals were and what the restriction would actually do. And I would say that here, Your Honor, as the district court found, it's clear that this law, as applied to these facts, will not serve any health interests. It will make women less safe because it'll force them to leave the state to access abortion. So it will not serve the credentialing interests because the hospitals won't even review the doctor's qualifications, and it won't serve continuity of care. As Your Honor said, there'll in fact be less continuity of care for women because they'll have to receive the medical care outside of the state from physicians and medical practices that are not subject to Mississippi's authority at all. So I believe that under any analysis of the undue burden standard, this law would fail. And the preliminary injunction that this district court entered was correct and should be affirmed.
Footnote 2, then.
Sure.
Footnote 2, your thoughts. That's almost the toughest issue for me, is whether or not a state itself isn't creating a burden when it delegates to third parties, and this gets into the remark made by opposing counsel that maybe there's a new owner of all these hospitals, and therefore maybe, in fact, privileges are about to be bestowed.
Again, Your Honor, I don't think you need to reach that issue here because the court
But what are your thoughts on non-delegation?
I think that it is unconstitutional for the state of Mississippi to delegate licensing authority of physicians to the hospitals. But I think the very important point here, Your Honor, is that when the state passes an abortion restriction, as it did here, we were absolutely right to sue the state, to pursue a challenge against the state to challenge that law. And it's not up to the hospitals to decide whether or not physicians are qualified. And part of the reason for that is that the hospitals often make decisions on privileges, not on anything having to do with doctors' qualifications, but for business reasons. And that's why it's inappropriate to delegate the licensing function to hospitals. So for all of these reasons, we would ask the court to affirm the preliminary injunction. If there are no further questions.
Have you said all you want to say?
I have, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We have some rebuttal now, Mr. Barnes.
Your Honor, first I would like to answer the judge's question about ambulatory surgical facilities. The definition is found on page 3 of our primary brief in footnote 1. An ambulatory surgical facility is any facility established primarily for the purpose of providing elective surgical treatment in an outpatient setting. It's specifically sub A. The district court in this case started in the temporary restraining order and in the first preliminary injunction with the assumption that any law which would close the only clinic is an undue burden. Now, the district court then did sprinkle a couple of conclusory statements in footnote 3 about medical necessity in the Rule 52B order, where he said, even assuming the balancing, the state has not come forward with sufficient evidence to overcome the proof that the plaintiffs have put on. By doing that, the approach taken by the district court put the burden on the state, whereas the burden is on the plaintiffs. And the fact that the district court was had that end in mind or that conclusion, that undermines the court's entire analysis. Even the district court in the Abbott case, even though we believe that court misapplied the rational basis scrutiny, the rational basis analysis, at least gave lip service to it and did look at the medical evidence and said, I'm not convinced by this medical evidence. Here, the district judge, you know, made no findings or conclusions whatsoever. We're not aware of any binding authority or any holding where a court of appeals has held that that consideration of out-of-state availability is absolutely permitted. Obviously, Judge Posner in Van Hollen doesn't like these laws one bit, but he did in passing mention that women in Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, do travel out of state. But Judge Mannion, in his concurrence in Van Hollen, specifically addressed the issue and said that in Judge Mannion's opinion, that the out-of-state availability did mitigate the practical impact and effect that such a law would have on women in Wisconsin and should therefore be considered. House Bill 1390, the admitting privilege requirement, does not strike at the right itself. Therefore, this is another way that the Gaines versus Canada case is distinguishable. Gaines versus Canada was direct discrimination of the, you know, invidious discrimination of the type, you know, particularly prescribed by the Equal Protection Amendment.
But what's happening across the country, and you can say it's vibrant and positive or not, is, and you know, since 24, just in this year alone, there are almost 1,000 bills introduced relating to sexual reproduction, et cetera. So you've got what New Hampshire's saying when we want buffer zones, and you've got California saying we'll let midwives do this. So you've got some states going indirectly favoring the right. Then you've got admitting privileges in other states, and every single one, I thought, comes into federal court, and we assess it on the continuum of, is this an incidental burden? Then it's okay. Or is it, and you quote the Whitman article, a total barrier, not okay? So I think admitting privileges, we've got to assess it on that continuum, and you're saying a regulation that closes the only clinic, it's not a total barrier because they can go to another state. That's the paradigm here, right?
Well, I think to some extent, yes, Your Honor. However,
I mean, if Gaines applies, you lose.
I would agree that if this court reaches a conclusion that regardless of whatever medical benefit the law might provide, that is superseded by that crossing a state line inherently creates some sort of an undue burden, then yes, we would lose. But we would urge the court not to reach that result because, for example, a few examples of laws which might be struck down under this. States are permitted to require that abortions are only performed by licensed physicians. That requirement has been upheld many times. However, what if this clinic, what if these two doctors in question, the two out-of-state doctors who fly in, what if they simply no longer decided, what if they decided this was too onerous, they didn't want to fly in, and therefore they did not have, you know, these out-of-state doctors perform abortions? Would the state then be required to permit non-licensed physicians or physicians' assistants to perform abortions?
That's a what if. And their answer to that is this was as applied.
Well, Your Honor.
And the district court was very careful to say
The distinction between as-applied challenges and facial challenges is not nearly as important as the district court made. The district court made a sharp distinction and said, I'm treating this as an as-applied challenge. However, the district court, the breadth of the relief which the district court awarded was facial in nature. He said this applies to every woman in the state of Mississippi. The state of Mississippi is barred from enforcing this law against anyone. So, you know, the main distinction between facial and as-applied challenges, as I understand it, is the breadth of the relief. So in another example, what if a major safety violation occurred, as one of the judges said, and would the state then be precluded from revoking the license? Or what if, you know, a clinic doctor was to lose their license in another state? Would the state of Mississippi be precluded from, you know, going to revoke that doctor's license to practice in the state of Mississippi? If you follow the analysis of the district court, the answer to all those questions would be yes, because those laws would have the effect of closing the only abortion clinic in the state. You have any further questions?
No, but I would suggest maybe you bring your argument to a close.
Yes, sir. The Constitution does not require Mississippi to treat abortion doctors differently from the way it treats other doctors. The Constitution does not require Mississippi to give preferential treatment to doctors just because they perform abortions. Yet that is exactly what the doctors here are requesting. And to hold that Mississippi cannot regulate the medical profession in this way would guarantee this particular clinic and these particular doctors a perpetual, unregulated existence beyond any reasonable state control or regulation. The plaintiffs failed to show a substantial likelihood of success on the merits.
Okay, Mr. Barnes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're getting into land we don't need to plow.